You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, pressure is mounting on EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt to leave his position as he deals with ethical controversies. We'll talk to an expert on political ethics about why she calls the situation shocking. Now, the Mediterranean diet has long been promoted as a heart-healthy way of eating. The diet itself focuses on consuming olive oil, whole fruits and vegetables, nuts, and lean meats like fish. While the diet's been popular for years, a groundbreaking study published about 5 years ago seemed to solidify its standing as one of the healthiest diets around. The research reported that people who followed the diet had a 30% lower chance of cardiovascular issues, things like heart attack and stroke. But this month, the study published in the New England Journal of Medicine was retracted, reanalyzed, and republished with a less forceful conclusion. Our next guest is here to talk about what happened and what it might mean for the way we eat. Elijah Wolfson is the science and health editor at the website Quartz. Elijah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Well, how big a deal is it, Elijah, that this study was pulled? A lot of attention went to this original study, right?
Yeah, so this is the single most cited study that's been done on the Mediterranean diet. It's been cited by other papers well over 3,000 times. The reason it's so influential is because it's one of the only studies on the diet to use a randomized controlled trial design, which is kind of the gold standard in science, in scientific research. And the idea is that you take a group of people and you randomly assign them either to a control group where they don't change any of their behaviors, or to one of the test groups where you ask them to specifically change something, in this case, how they are eating. The issue was that in this case, though it was supposed to be randomized, it actually wasn't fully randomized. And as a result, the findings, which initially seemed to suggest that the Mediterranean diet actually could cause improved heart health, all we can say now is that it correlates, and that's a pretty major difference.
Yeah, let's talk about the nature of the research here. I mean, long-term nutritional research is hard because you're trying to randomize as large a group of people as you can to eat a certain way for a long period of time, right? So these studies can be few and far between.
I mean, nutrition studies are really difficult because you really have to rely on self-reporting to begin with. So that's kind of, if there's one major issue, that's it, right? You can't really be with all, you know, if you have a study of 7,000 people, you can't be with 7,000 people at every breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You have to rely on them to actually report what they ate, and that's not, it's unlikely that they're going to report accurately. So that's a pretty big problem. Providing people with the right foods to fulfill a certain diet is really challenging as well. In addition, I mean, you're asking people to change the way they live, and that's not easy.
And with this particular study, I mean, they were trying to get villages full of some people to participate. Some of the non-random things were, how about a husband and wife? They end up doing the same part of the diet instead of being randomized. And do I have this right? One village was jealous that their neighbors were getting free olive oil, so they ended up participating in this kind of en masse?
Yeah, so what happened was, this study was done in Spain, throughout Spain, and the major problems were, the biggest problem was that whenever a married couple would come in, they would end up assigned to the same group, which undermines the random aspect of it, which is essential to a randomized controlled trial, right? So that was a problem to start. I can't presume to know what they were thinking at the time, but I'd imagine the researchers thought, well, hey, we can't make a married couple have two different diets. That would be really essentially impossible for them to actually do. So they would just assign them to the same group, but that undermines the whole process. And then there was this kind of amazing story where one of the field researchers decided to was working in a village, and he started assigning different people to different groups, but then residents of the village started coming to him complaining that their neighbors were getting free olive oil, and they felt that was unfair. And so he decided or she, I actually don't, I have no idea who it is. And I don't blame them for doing this. I could imagine it'd be a huge pain to deal with all these complaints. But that field researcher decided to assign the entire village to the Mediterranean diet group because they all wanted to get that free olive oil. And the problem was that the field researcher never reported making that decision. So that was kind of a hidden flaw in the study design.
Talking to Elijah Wolfson, science and health editor at the website Quartz, about the Mediterranean diet, some landmark research, as he said, much cited research, has been pulled back in its conclusions because of some of the basic ways the study was done. Elijah, I want to talk about what this means for what we eat. I'm guessing nobody's saying, hey, take that olive oil, throw it away fast, right? A lot of the Mediterranean diet we think is probably healthy stuff still, right?
Yeah, I don't think this really changes that. I mean, the reality is that the Mediterranean diet is such a kind of amorphous concept to begin with. You know, it basically just says eat fresh fruits and vegetables and less red meat and healthier fats like olive oil instead of butter and fish instead of pork. And that's not, in any case, that's healthy, right? So I don't think this really necessarily changes anything about that. It pulls back some of the outstated health claims that have been made about the diet in the past.
And is there a lesson here for how we read scientific news on nutrition? It seems like sometimes, and I've been guilty of this too, you see that study, here's this superfood, eat more. I'm like, okay, I'll eat a little more of that. Do we overcorrect sometimes based on what we read?
Yeah, it's really hard to assess nutrition studies accurately. Like I mentioned earlier, they're all self-reported, which makes them highly susceptible to error. And I'm sure, as you know, and your listeners probably know, that they seem to change all the time, right? So 1 week, chocolate's healthy for you, and the next it's not. And 1 week, a glass of red wine is healthy for you, and the next it's not. I think if there was any advice I'd give, it's to look at meta-analyses. So these review studies that are done occasionally, or fairly regularly, where they look at the recent history of studies on a given subject. And if you look at the meta-analyses of the Mediterranean diet, for example, what they would show is that, yeah, all of these studies suggest something, but none of them were designed well enough to actually say that this particular diet could really cause an improvement in heart health or brain health or weight loss. And so I think it's important to not look at any single study as though it's the new standard, but to kind of make sure you take a step back and look at the body of work.
And briefly, maybe some good news here. The reanalysis of this Mediterranean diet study came because somebody is out there looking at studies, trying to find things that might have gone wrong with them. Is this good news ultimately for how science is done and how old studies might be reevaluated?
Sure, yeah. I think it's definitely cause for some consternation in this science community, but it's probably for good reason. The more eyes on it, the better. I think that this type of work, it's really impacting a lot of areas of scientific research. Nutrition is a big one, and then psychology and behavioral science is probably the other big one. Science is incremental. It's one of the reasons it's so hard to report. It's always incremental. It's always changing slightly, and you need to kind of let it build and avoid overstating the findings of one specific study.
Elijah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Elijah Wolfson, science and health editor at the website Quartz. He joined us today to talk about the Mediterranean diet and why some key research has been, at least partially, retracted. First, pressure is mounting from lawmakers and political groups on Scott Pruitt to resign as administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Since taking the position, Pruitt has dealt with multiple ethics controversies. They range from using taxpayer money to pay for private travel and a soundproofed phone booth to pushing through pay raises for staffers after the White House had rejected them. While President Trump says he's unhappy about certain things, he says Pruitt has done a, quote, fantastic job. Virginia Cantor is chief ethics counsel for the nonprofit group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. She served as associate counsel for ethics to Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and as Treasury Department ethics counsel in the George W. Bush administration. Virginia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Rob.
You recently co-wrote an opinion piece on the controversies Scott Pruitt is dealing with. You said you've got a lot of experience doing this kind of stuff, and you're still seeing things that are surprising you from Administrator Pruitt.
Yes, I would say that we've never really seen anything quite like Administrator Pruitt. We believe there's credible evidence that he's engaged in a systemic pattern of corrupt activity that's really having a corrosive impact on EPA programs and operations. And we're concerned because the failure to hold them accountable sends a message that use of public monies and authorities for personal and financial benefit is not only acceptable, but it should also serve as a model for EPA employees and perhaps other government employees.
Yeah, we've seen testimony from EPA staffers before Congress, along with news reports, talking about the use of those officials for his private business, basically. Can you talk about what we've heard?
So, yeah, I think the most recent allegations involve the use of staff to obtain business opportunities for his spouse. And so that very much would affect Administrator Pruitt's own financial interests. So, for example, they apparently the staff assisted her in obtaining a $2,000 consulting gig at a three-day Concordia conference at which Administrator Pruitt spoke. They also assisted her in obtaining a temporary job for her as an independent contractor with a conservative judicial group, including, I guess, the resume was passed along to that group by the head of the Federalist Society, who had accompanied Administrator Pruitt to Rome and to the Vatican on an official trip. And then there were some less successful business opportunities that had been sought when the staff contacted the head of Chick-fil-A to see whether or not his wife could get a franchise. So those are, you know, examples of activities in which Administrator Pruitt actually had a financial interest.
And you wrote in that piece you co-wrote, I believe that this would have been a firing offense in previous administrations?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's a litany of items in which, you know, those are just a rough sample of a very few examples of when of the types of ethical transgressions he's engaged in. And there's, you know, multiple others. But in any other administration, clearly Mr. Pruitt would have been fired.
Another category of concerns people have raised has been the use of EPA staffers, not for, I guess, to get financial opportunities for his spouse, but for errands. Trying to get a used mattress right from a Trump hotel was one of them. Helping him find an apartment, I think, or housing in the Washington, D.C. area. And I think people might hear those and think, well, you know, that's kind of part of the job if you're an assistant to a major government official. What do the laws say about that?
No, the laws are very, you know, very clear that you cannot use public office for personal time. That there's an expectation that you will only be using public office for official purposes. And running errands is personal errands is definitely not one of them. And, you know, so in addition to the used mattress, there was, you know, sending or having his security detail help him locate a moisturizing lotion that he liked at the Ritz-Carlton. You know, these are completely unacceptable errands. And I'm not aware of anything like that ever.
Talking to Virginia Cantor with the nonprofit group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, a council for ethics for different departments in the last few presidential administrations, talking about EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt under increasing criticism, including members of the Republican Party. I want to give a listen to Scott Pruitt testifying in front of a congressional committee. I hear he is last month talking with senators about some of the ethics concerns.
And there have been decisions over the last 16 or so months that as I look back on those decisions, I would not make the same decisions again. And I'm sure we're going to talk about some of those. But some of the areas of criticism are frankly areas where processes at the agency were not properly instituted to prevent certain abuses from happening.
So I guess gray areas, the rules weren't clear to him. Is that an excuse? Is that something that could justify?
Well,
go ahead.
No, there's no excuse at all. There are ethics officials available at every agency who can very clearly explain what is expected of him in terms of, his use of staff time. And so that just doesn't ring true at all. And in fact, you know, what's really disconcerting is when EPA employees tried to address these issues, tried to tell him no, tried to blow the whistle, he appears to have retaliated against them for doing it. The rules are very clear. There's no mistake about it. Every other federal employee knows how to follow them. There's just no excuse for why the Administrator Pruitt has failed to do it.
Some of the other concerns people have raised, using staff to try to find, I think it was Rose Bowl tickets. Is that something similar? Have you seen anything like that before?
Well, you know, it's not uncommon to have questions arise about, you know, tickets to sporting events. Can I accept them? Under what circumstances? And in this case, he appears to have paid face value. And in general, if you pay for the tickets and you pay the face value of the ticket, that would be permitted under ethics rules. But you have to also look at the totality of the circumstances. And that is, are you getting something above and beyond what you would normally be entitled to? And frankly, you know, where you don't have, normally wouldn't have access to those types of tickets, I'm not sure that face value is, you know, paying face value is sufficient, because it's something that they had a much, much higher market value based on, you know, trying to, because they were basically inaccessible unless you had connections. And it seems like he got them through preferential treatment from somebody who had clients with matters before the EPA.
What damage is done if things like this happen and there is no accountability?
Well, basically, you're sending a message to, you know, government employees that this is acceptable behavior. And it is completely corrosive. It's corruptive. It's not consistent with any of the ethics laws and regulations. It's not consistent with the level of accountability that has been imposed on other federal officials in prior administrations. And so there's really no justification for it. In fact, the Office of Government Ethics just recently sent a letter to the EPA Inspector General asking them to accelerate their report into his alleged misconduct, because they want to begin a formal corrective, or decide whether they need to begin a formal corrective proceeding with regard to Mr. Pruitt.
Does the Office of Government Ethics have the power to do something, or does something have to happen? If Scott Pruitt doesn't resign himself, does the president ultimately have to take action? Congress? Who's the enforcer?
Ultimately, it will be up to the president to make the determination as to whether or not he should be fired, or whether, you know, he should ask for his resignation. This is, you know, in any other administration, this would be an easy call to make. He would, you know, in the baseball parlance, he would be called for an easy out. It's really inexplicable and unconscionable as to why he remains. It really calls into question the competence of the president in terms of exercising his managerial skills.
Are you surprised? This has gotten a fair amount of coverage, but it seems like there have been times where this would have been, you know, the top story in national politics, but there's so much other stuff going on. It, you know, is kind of the B or C or D story. Does this deserve more attention than it's getting?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, there's it's like I said, it's really inexplicable why he remains. I think there's a fog of other ethics issues that surround this administration, beginning with the president, you know, given that he retained his business interests and continues to accept monies from foreign governments and from federal and state governments at his own business institutions. There are a number of other secretaries who have their own ethics problems. For example, you know, Secretary Ross, you know, there's some questions about whether or not he's made false statements on his financial disclosure reports. There's questions about Secretary Carson at HUD and whether or not he, you know, improperly used funds, you know, to purchase dining room sets, and whether or not he improperly used his family in making arrangements for official activities. I mean, there's a lot of apparent ethical violations, and you know, maybe Mr. Pruitt has benefited from the fog.
Briefly, are you worried about this setting new standards for future administrations?
It is very worrisome for those of us who know what is expected of federal employees. I think it's very, very troublesome. I think that most government employees know this is entirely inappropriate conduct. In fact, the fact that you had his staff actually communicating with members of Congress and congressional staff about the extent of his improper behavior, it's basically a cry for help. It's like you have to do something. And I think it's incumbent upon Congress to really, you know, exercise its oversight function and to put pressure on the administration to remove the administrator.
Thanks to Virginia Cantor, Chief Ethics Counsel for the nonprofit group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, talking about EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. Now, many children arriving with their parents at the U.S. border have been separated from their parents after a policy change from the Trump administration increased the number of people arrested at the border. The images of children in holding areas have sparked protests around the country, and the practice has been condemned by faith leaders and current and former lawmakers. In a bit, we'll get the latest on what's happening at the border with a Washington Post correspondent. First, Representative Mark Pocan spoke with us this morning. He's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison. He visited McAllen, Texas over the weekend and toured one of the facilities housing these children. Representative Pocan, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, of course. Glad to be here.
Now, what did you see at this facility near the border?
Oh, a lot. You know, clearly the policy that the president's put forward, and it is the president's policy that's changed how things are being done at the border, is creating a lot of havoc, both from the people trying to manage the border to the real-life implications of people trying to get into the United States, whether it be for asylum or other purposes. The idea of separating children from their parents is really an important one. And, you know, when talking to the parents and seeing the children in essentially cages, this is just a practice that has to stop.
Can you talk a little more about what you saw with the kids themselves?
Yeah, it was really depressing. So we went to multiple facilities. In the first facility, the processing center, children 4 and under initially stay with a parent, even though the parents are separated. But the parents are separated from their children. Brothers are separated from their sisters. But if you're 4 or under, you can stay with a parent. But at 5, you're considered to be old enough to be put into essentially a pen or a cage, a chain link fence cage with about 50 other people you don't know. And then from there, you may wind up being sent to a detention center, which in one case is a former Super Walmart. It's now a Trump Super Detention Center. Where, again, children are not with their parents. When we talked to some of the parents who've had children taken away, when they told us where their children were, even though we were in Texas, in several cases, 2 people had children in Miami at a detention facility, 1 in New York. So they're sending people's children literally across the country in detention centers. This is just a practice that has no purpose. And the administration is only using this to try to somehow leverage money for a border wall, and it's done for all the wrong reasons. It's really the zero-tolerance policy has zero humanity, and we're there to see it up close.
The Trump administration has said, basically, they are now just fully enforcing laws that already existed. That's the only policy change. Congress could and should fix this, they say. What do you say to that?
Well, President Trump made the change. You don't go from 500 people in a facility in 6 weeks and then have 1,500 unless someone did something. And that's the change the president made. So either he's the most uninformed president in the 53 years I've been on the planet, or he's a liar. Either way, I don't feel very comfortable with the outcome. So this is a really important situation. The president's doing it just to try to get leverage for a wall, which is his kind of obsession, his Moby Dick moment. It's really just an awful, awful practice that hurts us around the world and is certainly hurting the children that we're separating from their parents.
And you called out Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen on Twitter. What do you think she's getting wrong about the border situation?
Everything. I know that they feel that, you know, especially when someone's newer in a position, they have to support the president's policy. But at some point, you take an oath to the United States, not to a cult leader. And when you just repeat everything that the president says, especially when you know it's a lie about the conditions and what you're doing, then you are also complicit in these actions. And I would argue that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are also complicit. Paul Ryan may say he doesn't want children taken away, but the best way to show that is you put some legislation on the floor that deals just with that. And the legislation this week is putting money out for a wall, trying to, again, force this. And they still don't resolve this issue in their so-called compromise legislation, which is a compromise among Republicans. And I still don't think will pass through the Senate. So what we're doing is nothing as Congress, and doing nothing is complicit with the practice.
Have you heard from Republican colleagues, any of them who might be on board with something like that, legislation specifically targeting this issue?
There absolutely would be people if Paul Ryan would let it go to the floor. I mean, every first lady, Democrat and Republican, has spoken out against this practice. This is something that really does cross partisan lines. It's immoral to separate children, young children, from your parents. We were told by some mothers they don't ask you anything when they take away your children. Sometimes they lie to you. They say they're taking them to the next room to take photos, and you never see your child again. At the first facility, the intake processing center, I asked how long someone gets to see their child every day, and they said, they tried to give a non-answer. I said, 15 minutes, 2 hours? They go, well, at least 15 minutes. Well, the first person they set up for us to talk to had not seen their 13-year-old daughter for 2 days. So, you know, part of it is the people on the ground are trying to deal with this change that the president did, and there's no way to really implement it as fast as it's happening. And, you know, it makes it really tough on the people who are actually there working in these facilities trying to help children. When you have growth that's three times in 6 weeks, you just can't handle it.
What do you make of the reaction you've seen from the public on this issue?
The public is absolutely against this policy. I've seen it across almost every political division, every demographic. You know, they tried to somehow use the Bible to justify this. There was an outcry among many people that you would argue might be in Donald Trump's base. This is something that across the board we should all be opposing because it's wrong. You don't do this just to support the president. This is something where you help the president realize he made a bad mistake if you're an ally. And yet we're not seeing enough Republicans stand up to do that. So my hope is that as we get back to Congress this week, Wednesday, we are going to have amendments in my Appropriations Committee. The HHS budget is before us to try to deal with this, and we'll see if we can get Republicans to do the right thing.
Representative Pocan, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Representative Mark Pocan is a Democrat who represents Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison. He joins today to talk about what he saw while visiting the southern border of the U.S. and one of the facilities housing children separated from their families. Nick Miroff joins us now with the latest on the story. He's a national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Happy to be with you.
You've been covering how this process is working, how children are separated, and whether or not they end up reuniting with their families. What are you seeing day to day down there?
Well, that's one of the biggest problems with the system, for especially for immigrant advocacy groups. The separation part is very quick and efficient, but the reuniting part is not. And so parents are in some cases unsure where their children have been sent to foster care. they're spending weeks, if not months, to get them back. And we're hearing some really awful stories of parents being deported back to Central America while their children remain in foster care.
Talk about the step-by-step process here. These parents are being charged with, I believe it's a federal misdemeanor. Do I have that right, first of all?
That's right. It's a misdemeanor charge, illegal entry. So in most cases, they go before a magistrate, and they're sentenced to time served after they plead guilty. Now, they could be sent from there into ICE detention. That's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Those are the folks who would deport them. They await a deportation, but while they're in jail, they can't have their children back. So their children go to foster care, and they have limited contact with their children and a limited ability to coordinate a reunion, let alone know when that's going to occur.
And the big change, and there seems to be controversy about that, but the policy change here is that previously we didn't charge all of these parents with this misdemeanor, didn't start that legal process necessarily, and then thus they weren't separated from their children. Is that the essence of the policy change here?
That is the essence of the policy change. It's an effort by the Department of Justice and DHS to criminally charge 100% of the people who cross the border illegally with that crime. So that means parents who bring children are separated from their kids.
I want to listen to audio released yesterday by ProPublica, the news agency that illustrates the state the kids are at these facilities. Here's a listen.
Bueno, aquí tenemos una orquesta.
The translation, I understand, is, well, we have an orchestra here, right? What's missing is a conductor. The audio that they obtained lasts about 8 minutes, featuring Border Patrol agents, consular workers, and others, and children throughout. What's been the reaction to this audio and just the general state of these detention centers?
Well, I think that the detention centers themselves have been less of an issue than just the sheer fact of, you know, the government deliberately doing this to people. The images of some of these children and families in a processing center in McAllen that has like chain link pens, the place that's nicknamed the dog kennel, has certainly upset many folks who maybe, you know, didn't realize that this center has been in operation for many years. But again, I think the thing that people are responding to most viscerally are, you know, instances like this, like the recording you just played, where you're just confronted with the suffering of young children that is being, you know, intentionally inflicted. And, you know, to have that done by the government is something that now we're seeing, you know, many Republicans just can't bear.
Talking to Nick Miroff, national security correspondent for The Washington Post, giving us the latest news on what's happening with children being separated from their parents at the Mexico-U.S. border. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what's happening, this policy that leads to children being separated from their parents at the border? What questions do you have for our guest about the procedures and the politics here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the latest on children being separated from their parents when they cross into the U.S. Illegally or present for an asylum application. Our guest is Nick Miroff, national security correspondent for The Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on what's happening? What are your questions for our guest as he covers these issues? Before we go to our callers, Nick, I want to give a listen to Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. I talked about the policy at a press conference. She's been a point person on this. Here's a conversation between her and a reporter.
The last administration, the Obama administration, the Bush administration, all separated families at the... They absolutely did. They did. Their rate was less than ours. but they absolutely did do this. This is not new.
Minors, there's no doubt about that. But this,
they separated families.
Kids at this rate from their parents is something new and specific to this administration. Once the Attorney General announced the zero tolerance policy, so why doesn't the president pick up the phone and change the policy? He said he hates it.
I think what the president is trying to do is find a long-term fix. So why don't we have Congress change the laws to change... No, Congress could fix this tomorrow.
So talk about that. We're hearing, I believe it's now 12 Republican U.S. senators writing to the Trump White House saying, hey, fix this now. You will work on immigration, but you need to stop this policy now. What's the back and forth? Nick.
Yes. The president is meeting right now with Republican lawmakers on the Hill. But, as you just mentioned, we're seeing this groundswell of opposition to the policy. It's just something that a growing number of lawmakers simply aren't comfortable with. And calls to fix the problem, well, they may sound good. Anyone who works here in Washington is familiar with how this works, knows that it's not going to be that fast. Particularly given that the Trump administration continues to view this as a kind of leverage in negotiations over a broader immigration package.
I want to go to our callers now. We've got Eric in Appleton with us. Eric, hi.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask the guest, why are immigrants coming through a legal port of call or port of entry versus going through the illegal routes, which this would actually make their asylum request a little bit briefer, and it would, in most cases, avoid the separations that they're suffering currently.
Eric, thanks for the call. So entering through legal ports of entry versus not.
That's right. The caller is correct. The administration is saying that if families come to the ports of entry, those are the legal border crossings, to seek asylum, then they will not be separated. One of the problems with that is that we've documented, and other media organizations have documented, multiple instances of U.S. Customs officers standing on the border bridges to try to pre-screen migrants coming to seek asylum. They are turning them back and telling them that there isn't room. There have been cases of families coming back more than a dozen times trying to get into the ports of entry. Again, this is one of the reasons why people cross illegally over the river, in order to physically establish their presence in the United States and be able to start the process. So while that is what DHS is saying, there are challenges, too, to seeking asylum the right way.
Thanks for that call, Eric. We'll go next to Jim in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, hi.
Hi. Well, I wish that people would do just a tiny bit of research on the Internet about the conditions these children are kept in. It's much better than the condition of tens of millions of American citizen children living in poverty. They have much better diet and health care and activities to engage in there. You might well wonder about parents who would put their children in a situation where they know that this is going to happen. When they commit a crime, I don't know of any other crime, whether it's shoplifting or drunk driving or whatever, where you're allowed to take your kids with you into prison. But it really, it's just terrible that these parents would put their children in such a dangerous situation before even they are arrested.
Jim, thanks for the call. Nick, can you talk about the conditions for the kids? He's saying roughly what the Trump administration has said.
Yeah, I'll just make 2 points. I mean, your caller said that American citizens wouldn't have to be able to take their kids with them to jail. I think while your caller has a point, American citizens wouldn't, and parents would not go to jail over a misdemeanor charge. And when they would get out of jail, they wouldn't be kept from their kids for weeks or even months at a time. On the second point, the caller brings up conditions in the HHS shelters, which really I don't think are as much of an issue. A lot of migrant kids actually say, you know, aside from the food, that the conditions are pretty good relative to what they've experienced along the journey. HHS has a licensing program to make sure that these shelters do comply with basic standards. And I haven't seen, too much evidence indicate that that is really the issue here.
Thanks for that call, Jim. We're talking to Nick Miroff from The Washington Post about the latest at the U.S. border and family separation. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
I have a question for your guests. Most immediate public opinion polls show that the vast majority of Americans, 67%, disapprove of this zero-tolerance policy, but that 58% of Republicans do. Does this show a fundamental issue of values between the two parties? And most importantly, isn't this really an issue of race that Trump generated when he ran in this anti-immigrant policies at the time of his election? I'll be interested in every guest's response.
Jim, thanks for the call. Nick, your thoughts on the partisan divide on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think your caller speaks to the credibility deficit here from an administration that has used very overheated rhetoric to describe both Latin American immigrants and illegal immigrants, depicting them with a broad brush as gang members and rapists and so forth. And that just doesn't match the images that Americans are seeing on their televisions of a lot of humble and destitute families showing up at the border. And as far as what was the first part of your caller's question?
The percentages disapproval rate and about 2/3 of Americans disapprove, but a majority of Republicans approve of the policy and how that's driving the politics of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think as we're seeing in this country and all over the world, there's a lot of anxiety about immigration and about rapid demographic and cultural change. But so far, what this is suggesting is that these types of measures just go too far for too many people.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Terry in Appleton. Terry, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to say I'm absolutely appalled by this, and I can't believe that people would think that these kids are being treated fairly when we hear them crying as they're being separated from their parents. And I'm wondering if there are any rules or laws out there that protect these children and protect minors from something like this happening, where we're putting them behind cages in our own country.
Terry, thanks for the call. Nick, any laws about the welfare of these children while in custody or being detained?
Sure. There are tons of laws that govern these centers, how they operate, what they're approved to do. I think, you know, I have not, again, seen many credible reports, at least recently as part of this recent crisis, of stories of abuse. I mean, when you're hearing that those wailing children, those are children who have been recently separated from their families by the United States Border Patrol. This is not something they're experiencing in a HHS foster care shelter. So while the kids are being kept in those detention cage-like cells, that's really only for a brief amount of time, maybe 48 hours before they're going into HHS custody.
Thanks for that call, Terry. Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Anytime.
That's Nick Miroff, National Security Correspondent for The Washington Post. He joined us to give us the latest in the political fight at the border over the Trump administration's use of a policy that separates children from their parents when they cross the border illegally or arrive seeking asylum in some cases.